Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Bob Oakes, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. After the Great Recession came the jobless recovery. Millions have been getting by on unemployment checks, but benefits have started to expire, and life in a lot of American homes has surely gotten harder. Some economists and politicians think nudging people off the unemployment rolls is, in the end, good for them and good for the economy. This hour on Point, the big debate over unemployment benefits. You can join the conversation. Are you out of work? Have your benefits dried up? You can also comment on our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining us this hour are three people who study working life and the labor force in this country. First in the studio, Barry Bluestone, labor economist and dean at the School of Public Policy and Urban Affairs at Northeastern University, also founding director of the Dukakis Center for Urban and Regional Policy at Northeastern. Barry, good to see you again.
Good to see you.
Joining us from Washington is James Shirk. He's a labor economist and senior policy analyst at the Heritage Foundation. Hi, James.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. And Catherine Newman is joining us from New York. She's a labor sociologist at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School and author of several books on working in America, her most recent being Who Cares? Public Ambivalence and Government Activism from the New Deal to the Second Gilded Age. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, Bob.
So, Barry, I'm going to start with you. Why don't you set the table for us here? Give us some statistics. How many Americans out of work right now? How many Americans about to lose benefits as the Senate fiddles and diddles, as the late Johnny Most, the play-by-play person for the Boston Celtics, used to say when he was describing the ball going down the court and really moving nowhere?
Well, we're fiddling and diddling. We've got an unemployment rate at 9.5%, and by now most people had hoped it would be down under 9%. But it looks like it's going to be up in the 9s and could even rise throughout the rest of the summer, maybe even to next year unless we get some more stimulus. That means that 14.6 million people are currently officially unemployed, 14.6 million. And in fact, we only gained about 83,000 private sector jobs last month, so we continue to have this very high number. But in addition to that, we have about 8.6 million people who would like full-time jobs and can't find them. They're not receiving unemployment benefits. And we have another 2.6 million people who are discouraged. That is, they've just given up. Many of them are not receiving benefits either because they're not looking for jobs any further. That means that one in six Americans in the labor force are unemployed or working less than they would like, 16.6%. We've not seen those numbers that high for a long time. And even in 1980, when they got that high, in fact, the unemployment rate hit 10.8% in November of 1982, the unemployment rate came down very rapidly after that. And so people were able to find jobs. Today, we only have about for every five people looking for work, we only have about one job. So even if all the people who are unemployed were thrown off of unemployment insurance, four out of five of them would not be able to find a job today.
Is this too big a problem for the American Congress to deal with?
It shouldn't be. Extending unemployment benefits should be almost a matter of course, not only because people are desperate for their unemployment insurance, which, by the way, only averages about $310 a week or $15,000 a year, but it may help some families keep their home and keep food on the table. But the fact is if we do not extend unemployment benefits, it will make the recession even worse. People will not be able to find jobs. They'll even cut back further on whatever spending they can do today. That means more people will be unemployed. The deficit will explode. And so virtually all economists, but a very small number, from right to left, believe that we should stimulate the economy immediately, worry about the deficit in the couple years to come, one of the best ways to do that would be to extend unemployment benefits. The other way would probably be to give some more funds to the state and local government who desperately need stimulus, or, in fact, they're going to be laying people off, too.
Just so we're clear on this, your view is that by extending unemployment benefits, we help the economy because people spend whatever they get in. If they're getting a $200 check or a $400 check or a $500 check, they're spending that money.
Every penny of it.
James Shirk, why is extending benefits such a hard sell in the Senate at this point?
Well, the issue right now is not are benefits going to be extended. You've got both Republicans and Democrats agreeing on that. The question is, how is it going to be financed? The Democrats are quite insistent that there be no spending cutbacks anywhere else, that it be simply adding to the deficit. And the Republicans are saying this is close to $100 billion a year we're spending on these extended benefits. That's serious money, and you need to budget for it, and you can't just do it under this emergency spending where there's no offsets. And so what the Republicans were proposing is, all right, well, the stimulus hasn't worked all that well, so if you want to spend more money on this and you're claiming it's a stimulus, well, let's take it from some of the other stimulus spending and cut back the other spending in the stimulus. And the Democrats weren't too enthused about reducing the spending, so they weren't willing to take that sort of compromise. So it's much more a fight over how is it going to be financed. Do we have other spending cutbacks to afford this? And I think that's a fairly reasonable position. If these are a priority, well, then surely they're more of a priority than a lot of the other spending Congress has. If these are so important, surely they're more important than the other $3.8 trillion worth of things that Congress spends money on.
Barry, you're looking skeptically.
Well, the thing is that we need to stimulate the economy. So the best thing we could do is to use deficit financing for this. Of course, we're deficit financing for the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan. It seems to be domestically using deficit finance to stimulate the economy and give people the funding they need to at least keep their homes and keep them well fed makes a lot of sense. So I think the Democrats are right on economic grounds. We should be funding this out of increased deficit rather than just shifting from one pocket to another.
But are you saying that that the argument is unreasonable? Trying to figure out how we're going to pay for the $34 billion that it's going to cost us to extend these benefits?
There's no doubt that in the long run we have a deficit problem. But most economists would say, don't worry about the deficit this year. Get the economy rolling quicker, and that will help reduce the deficits in the future. So in fact, the whole question about, well, we have to pay for this out of money that's already been allocated is a red herring. Unfortunately, I fear that the Republicans feel for political reasons that keeping the unemployment as weak as possible through November will help their chances at the polls. And therefore, we have this stalemate, which is helping no one and hurting people who are unemployed quite badly.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, James.
No, I was going to say that's not the issue at all. Your statement would have been correct if you said most Keynesian economists. There's large numbers of neoclassical economists who don't believe that this government spending is tremendously stimulative at all. And my research has showed that certainly there's humanitarian reasons to extend unemployment insurance, but that once you get it up to the extent we have it now of 2 years, that the other effects it has in the economy counteract whatever economic benefit there are. This isn't people trying to be cynical and cause economic pain. The stimulus hasn't worked so far. We haven't seen the unemployment rate come down despite the enormous government spending. And there's a lot of economists who are quite skeptical. All the government is doing is moving money around in the economy. It's not creating new wealth when it borrows more money. And so there's very good reasons to be skeptical that this government spending is going to actually be so helpful to the economy.
Barry.
James, the fact is that it's hard to measure what the stimulus effect has been because it's kept things from getting worse than they might have otherwise been. The other thing is the stimulus we've had so far has actually not been that strong. Total government spending actually hasn't grown that much because state and local governments have cut back so sharply that much of the strong stimulus from the federal government, about $800 billion, hundreds of billions of dollars of less state and local funding have offset that. So we really haven't even tried much stimulus yet.
Catherine, I'm going to bring you in a minute, but I just want to ask both of these gentlemen, why not have this debate after the unemployment benefits are extended as opposed to having it before the benefits are extended this time again? Because in the meantime, we're creating pain and anxiety for millions of Americans who are looking for and need this money.
Well, I think in the end that compromise may be the only way to get this through, and you're right. Bob, I think the pain is so great out there that just on simple compassion reasons, the Democrats may have to concede and fund this out of other stimulus funding just so that these people can get some more unemployment benefits.
I'd say, again, the Democrats were offered a deal before the recess where half of the spending would come out of the stimulus and half would be additional deficit financing. And that wasn't a deal they were willing to accept. They wanted things their way and were willing to compromise. I think there's room for compromise, and that's probably ultimately what we're going to see.
Catherine Newman, from your point of view, how anxious are people out there right now who are looking down, who are looking at their mailboxes, wondering whether this money is coming?
I think they're extraordinarily anxious. They're worried about more home foreclosures if they can't pay the mortgage. They're worried about how they're going to keep food on the table, and that's not something American families are accustomed to worrying about. I'd like to inject another issue here, though. There is more than unemployment insurance to be worried about. We've got, as Barry put it, millions of people who are sitting on the sidelines watching their human capital go to rot. And while I favor increasing unemployment insurance, and I think it's absolutely necessary for all the reasons that have been mentioned, I do worry that we don't think as much as we could more creatively as they did in the 1930s about direct job creation by the federal government and by the states, which is basically what the states are doing with the stimulus money. They're keeping people employed as teachers and firemen and policemen. Because we don't gain at all by having millions of people sit on the sidelines. When the economy recovers, it's going to be very difficult for them to find new jobs because they will be lacking in the kinds of references and recent job experience that employers will be looking for.
This is On Point. I'm Bob Oakes, in today for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about unemployment and unemployment benefits. We're joined this hour by Barry Bluestone, labor economist at Northeastern University, by Catherine Newman, labor sociologist at Princeton, and by James Shirk, labor economist and senior policy analyst at the Heritage Foundation. Back in May, Sharon Engel, a Nevada Republican who's been campaigning to unseat Senate Majority Leader Senator Harry Reid, was interviewed by a local TV channel, KRNV. She made waves around the country when she gave voice to the suspicion many Americans have that there's a moral hazard to unemployment benefits.
You can make more money on unemployment than you can going down and getting one of those jobs that is an honest job, but it doesn't pay as much. And so that's what's happened to us, is that we have put in so much entitlement into our government that we really have spoiled our citizenry and said, you don't want the jobs that are available.
Catherine, I imagine that there are many people who are not going to like the sound of what Sharon Engel said, but is she right on some of this point, on some of her points? When you can't find the kind of job that you've had before that's right for you and your family, is it right for you and your family and the community for you to take whatever work you can find until things look up?
That's exactly what most Americans are doing. Sharon Engel doesn't seem to understand what her own constituents are having to go through. They are taking jobs for which they're overqualified when they can convince employers to give it to them. In fact, the biggest problem is for the downwardly mobile, those who are looking for jobs for which they're overqualified, can't get employers to take them seriously because they can be very, very picky in a high unemployment environment and find the person who they think exactly matches their requirements. It was a very interesting article in the New York Times this morning about the nation's census takers who are being laid off by the droves now. And you look at the background of people who are just walking the streets counting people in houses, which is not brain surgery. These are experienced managerial and executive workers who were turfed out in the economy. They are taking jobs for which they're very overqualified. There's absolutely no way in which they're just sitting around, lazing around on unemployment benefits. The problem she cites is so tiny, it's so negligible, it isn't even worth the airtime she gave it. The far more important problem is that we've got millions of people who are desperate to go back to work, for whom Unemployment insurance benefits are a stopgap. It's an important stopgap, but it is not the solution. The solution is to get these people back into the labor force, which is where they want to be. When I studied workers in Harlem, when unemployment was running at 25% in central Harlem, I found adults trying to support families on minimum wage jobs, and there were 14 job seekers for every job available. It is simply not the case that Americans are so picky that they won't take jobs which almost barely pay for their family's upkeep. They will take almost any kind of job ahead of going on to unemployment insurance because it's not dignified in our culture, and we share that value 100% across the class spectrum.
Marketplace question, Catherine. The longer people are out of work, is it harder for them to find meaningful work?
It's harder for them to find any kind of work. And this is, to me, the most important crisis building over the long term. People who have been out of work for more than a year face a very difficult task in finding any kind of job once the economy recovers. Now, when unemployment is driven down very, very low, we have the opposite portrait. Then we get employers who will look at populations they used to ignore, like young black men with poor educations. When we look at the Massachusetts miracle in the early 1980s or the New York economy in the late 1990s, which were periods of extremely low unemployment, we find that all of those workers who were at the back of the employment queue for many, many years, flooding back into the labor market and being hired because under tight labor markets, employers don't have much of a choice but to look at people they used to ignore. So the match between workers and employers is very sensitive to the unemployment rate. And right now what we've got is such laxness out there that employers can be very picky. And the worry is over the long run, when we recover, these people won't recover. Older workers will find it very difficult to find new jobs, and young job seekers who are entering a very weak labor market will have a scarred biography. And that'll make it very hard for them to get back on their feet. And that's what all the research shows from the Great Depression era, and it's what it shows from the early 1980s. Those wage losses followed those generations for decades after the lousy economies abated. So this is why I personally would like to discuss more than just unemployment insurance and start thinking about direct job creation of the kind that was done in the 1930s that put 4 million people back to work in 9 months. In the early part of the New Deal, because we need these people to develop the human capital and keep it burnished so that when we recover as an economy, they can stay in the labor force.
Stephen is calling from Windham, Connecticut. Hi, Stephen, and thanks.
Hi, fellas and lady. I have to agree with her. I work in a field where we're high-end techs, and we're getting paid 60, 70, some even more than that. And they're all downscaling. I just was sitting with a friend of mine. He's working on a clamming boat. You know, he just made $17,000 up to this point. You know, that's and another guy who walked away from his house, just got kicked out of his apartment. He has to rewrite his resume so it looks like that job fits him and not that he's smarter or he won't even get anything. So you know, we can spend money on AIG, we can fight the hillbillies in Afghanistan. We can rebuild the country of Iraq. You know, if I had Goldman and Sachs between my name, maybe they'd help me out, too.
Are you, what are you and your friends thinking about the Senate delay on re-upping the authorization for unemployment benefits?
It's insulting. It's insulting because you're out there trying to make things happen for yourselves. And this is insulting because a lot of these guys, you know, one of my friends got denied unemployment because he worked and then the work ended because it was a temporary job and he made over whatever. And now, I don't know how that works, but the federal thing got denied. And these people need, you know, and that's why he lost his house. It's insulting. They really need to come down to humanness, you know. We're not corporations. We're human beings.
Stephen, thank you very much. Barry Bluestone.
Well, Stephen's made a great point. I mean, the problem is that we haven't seen this kind of pain on the streets in decades. The economy has been weaker, and it has been, for all intents and purposes, a jobless recovery, despite the fact that we're seeing GDP, gross domestic product, rise at about 2.8% a year. Productivity has just soared because firms are trying to worried about the future are trying to do more work with fewer people. And that's across the board. Even now we see attempts by hospitals to cut back on staff. And that was the one area that continued to grow and grow and grow. So I have not seen, in looking at the economy for 30-plus years, I have never seen a time that was as dismal as this for the job seeker or as uncertain for those people who still have jobs in many, many industries.
So what frightens you most?
I think what frightens me the most is that we seem to be at a time, and we had a little of it in the 1930s, thankfully Roosevelt came and kind of changed it, where people are so scared that they become very conservative, very reactionary. You see the Tea Party movement, you see Republicans time after time doing things that are not helping the economy. You see the battle between Barack Obama, the president, the Congress, stalemated over one bill after another. And I worry that we have a kind of animus in society right now, everybody trying to blame somebody else, and in the meantime, millions, in fact, tens of millions of people paying the price for that.
John is calling from Des Moines, Iowa. Hi, John.
Hi, Bob. I echo Stephen, your first caller. This is not the workers' fault. We're going to face some social upheaval in this country. I think the actual unemployment is probably closer to 15% to 20% because of the people that have dropped out of the seeking work and aren't officially on the records yet. A European-style unemployment, I don't think it ever stops. America has this attitude, American business has this attitude that, you know, let them eat cake. Well, you know, it's to the point where you can't even afford the cake anymore. And the worse this gets, the more you're going to see homeless shelters fill up with families, and unemployment is designed to ease that transition from unemployment back to employment, and it's just not happening. And until that happens, until the numbers change and the numbers are accurate, you're going to see more and more turmoil and more foreclosures, more and more homeless, et cetera, et cetera. And I'll take your comments off the air.
John, thank you very much. James Shirk, why don't you comment on John's observations that we're going to see more social upheaval in America?
Well, I think we've already seen quite a lot of social upheaval, and I agree with the other people here that what we need to do is get jobs being created. You've got a long-term problem if you've got people whose skills are deteriorating over time with a prolonged period of time outside the labor force. But the question is, where do jobs come from? What creates a job? And the answer is, it's a businessman or an entrepreneur who has an idea for a good or service that someone else values, that he combined with investors, hires these workers to produce this good or service of value. We could very easily have the government pay people to dig holes and fill those holes back in again, which was more or less what a lot of the New Deal programs were in the Great Depression. But as we saw in the Great Depression, they didn't work. The unemployment rate stayed in the double digits, for the most part, over 15% until after World War II. Simply having the government have people do make-work projects doesn't create wealth in the economy, and so it doesn't create lasting jobs.
But millions of jobs were created at that time. Millions of jobs were created at that time, and you can argue about whether they were folks digging holes and then filling them in again, but there were productive people in the economy, and they were spending money.
But those are, again, millions of jobs were created there. Those are visible. They're seen. They're easily observed. You don't see that the millions of jobs that weren't created because the government was spending that money on having people dig ditches and fill it back in again. If private businesses had invested that money, you would have created new wealth in the economy, not simply make-work projects. And with that new wealth, you would have had wages for workers to demand more goods and services. You would have created more new jobs elsewhere in the economy. That's why there's a number of studies that have shown that countries that attempt to reduce the unemployment rate by having government job creation actually don't have any lower unemployment rates. Sweden tried this in the early 90s, and it didn't work.
Catherine
they lost
Newman.
More jobs.
Catherine Newman, weigh in.
I'm sorry, I just think this history is backwards. The unemployment rate was cut in half by the New Deal programs. It didn't solve the unemployment problem, but unemployment was up at 25% before these New Deal programs kicked in. And then Roosevelt took his foot off the gas because he started listening to people who had a similar point of view to James, who were telling him he needed to worry about deficit spending. And so they stopped these programs, and the unemployment rate shot back up again. But to cut unemployment in half is not a small achievement. And I also think we should develop a healthy respect for what those New Deal programs left in their wake. They didn't leave ditches and holes. They left new roads, new schools, the nation's most beautiful parks.
And enormous amount of public art around the country as well.
We are still enjoying, you know, decades later, the fruits of the labor that our WPA and CWA workers left behind. I'm not suggesting this is the ultimate solution. I do agree with James that private sector job creation is critical. But if you put people back to work so that their skills remain burnished and that they spend the earnings that they have and they don't lose their homes, then you have more capital floating around to fuel the private sector. We certainly don't gain by having these people sit on the sidelines, let their skills go to rack and ruin, and let them lose all their assets. I see absolutely no benefit in that. So I think we need to look more carefully at the record of the New Deal, because it is not it is really not as it's being characterized. To cut the unemployment rate from 25% to 13% in the space of about 2 years is not a trivial accomplishment. If we could cut today's unemployment rate in half, we would have a lot of Americans with greater confidence, willingness to spend, and a lot less distress among American families than we have right now.
Barry Bluestone.
Well, I think 2 points, Bob. And Catherine's got it exactly right in terms of the history of the Great Depression and the New Deal. In fact, James actually mentioned the program that did put us back to full employment. In fact, back to 1.2% unemployment in 1943. It was called World War II, but it was the biggest government spending program we ever had. It wasn't private business that ran World War II. It was the Defense Department. And in fact, it was the biggest job creator ever. The other point I think that's really important, and this is where James and I may disagree, is that we have to ask the question, why isn't business investing in new jobs now? And the reason is they have very little confidence that the economy is now going to expand, and therefore they're retrenching. What we need to do is give them the confidence that, in fact, there's going to be enough stimulus out there that there are going to be sales of the services or products they're making, and that's when they'll begin hiring again. So to a great extent, the reason for stimulating the economy generally and extending unemployment benefits so we don't have a cutback in spending is to restore private sector confidence so we can get that job creation that we need.
James Shirk.
Well, certainly we need businesses to have that confidence, but part of what we have to remember is causing them to be so unconfident is the current political climate. We've got the prospect of higher taxes, where the health care bill is going to make it more expensive for them to hire new employees. We've got the entire regulatory agenda, like the Environmental Protection Agency, going to be regulating carbon dioxide, which will massively raise business costs, but they're not sure how it's going to be. I mean, you've got this this entire agenda of, to quote the president, spreading the wealth around, which doesn't create the right incentives to create wealth in the first place. It's ultimately counterproductive. What we should be looking at doing things is reducing business costs, things like tort reform, or things like the pending free trade agreements with Colombia and South Korea. Things like that expand opportunities for businesses to invest and create wealth, and when they can do that, they can create jobs. But to go quickly back to the New Deal, the reason we had the unemployment rate drop so quickly was not anything FDR did, but it was the Federal Reserve, basically. Between 1929 and 1933, they cut the money supply by a third. Well, that's just horrible policy. And they eased up on that after 1933. Fortunately, we have a Federal Reserve that's a bit wiser today, so we're not likely to see anything quite that destructive that got unemployment up to 25%.
This is On Point. I'm Bob Oakes in for Tom Ashbrook. We're discussing unemployment benefits running out and what to do now. We're joined this hour by Barry Bluestone, labor economist at Northeastern University, also by Catherine Newman, labor sociologist at Princeton, and by James Shirk, labor economist and senior policy analyst at the Heritage Foundation. Republicans led the charge against extending unemployment benefits this year in the Senate. In May, New Hampshire U.S. Senator Judd Gregg appeared on a Fox talk show and said an extension of benefits would stop job mobility and create, quote, a European situation.
You're out of the recession, you're starting to see growth, and you're clearly going to dampen the capacity of that growth if you basically keep an economy which encourages people to, rather than go out and look for work, to stay on unemployment.
Listeners, how would you encourage job growth in America? Tom is calling from Charleston, South Carolina. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Bob. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Okay, thank you. I think the main long-term way to deal with job growth in this country is to get away from the anti-business, heavy taxation type program that, if you look back at the history of the Hoover FDR New Deal program, I would recommend to all readers look into reading Burton Folsom's book called New Deal, Raw Deal, which looks empirically at the economic results of Hoover's and FDR's programs during that era, and makes a hash out of what the history books taught us in the 8th grade and the 12th grade American history classes that we all went through as kids. There's still some question on what the real reason for the length and depth of the Depression is, but the answers kind of cluster around lack of confidence in the group of people that are entrepreneurs and investors that were capable of taking risk with themselves, their ideas, and their own resources to create new enterprises during that era, and therefore crushed jobs. Roosevelt crushed jobs by removing money from people's pockets with his excise taxes, the revenues from which exceeded income taxes for quite a bit of his first two terms of administration, when unemployment was never below double digits. We're seeing enough of a parallel with the Hoover FDR program right now that if we continue on this road, we're going to see another nice long extension of the recession.
Just so I'm clear on this, in your view, Tom, what's the number one job growth inhibitor in America right now?
Anti-business attitude in terms of rulemaking, the frequency of rule changing, and the threat of almost punitively high taxes, both at the income tax level and in some of the recent legislation, such as the healthcare and financial industry legislation that's underway right now.
And just so I'm also clear about this, if you were on Capitol Hill right now and you had a vote in the Senate, would you vote to extend or to not extend unemployment benefits?
I would tend to vote against extending unemployment benefits, but to take immediate action to correct the trend in the administration's policy orientation and stabilize and lay down clear ground rules for people that need, that are entrepreneurs and investors. They are the ones who create new jobs, not the government. As other commentators have stated before, government jobs are funded by removals of resources from the private economy. They do not create new wealth in the economy. The idea of consumer spending bouncing the economy back is just doesn't work in the numbers. So I would want more of a long-term approach to this.
All right, I think we got it. Barry Bluestone wants to weigh in.
I agree with Tom on one point, and that is that we should have clear, stable regulation. And when we're changing regulations all the time, that can have an adverse effect on the business climate. But if you look at recent history, the real problems that we had came about not because we overregulated the economy, but because we deregulated the economy. When we had a more regulated economy and, in fact, higher corporate income taxes, we actually had faster growth. So the correlation is exactly the opposite of what our caller just suggested. And then what we did is we deregulated industries. We deregulated airlines, bus, train transportation, some of the utilities. Clinton, Carter, Reagan, they all helped deregulate. Clinton cut Glass-Steagall, and that led in part to the banking crisis, which is really part of the reason why we're in such deep trouble today. So we want clear, stable regulation, but to deregulate is not necessarily the answer to creating jobs or a stable economy.
James Shirk.
Well, I think if you compare the economic performance of, say, the 1980s and the 1990s with that of the 1970s, you'll see that a lot of those deregulations were actually quite helpful. Airline tickets is affordable for middle-class Americans in a way that it wasn't before the 1970s. A lot of those reforms were very good and helped the economy. But you can't simply paint with a broad brush and say all regulations are good or all are bad. And certainly there were some mistakes made in the way that the financial sector was regulated. But the broader point is that it's not government that creates the new wealth. As the caller said, the government can only take the wealth from someone else in the economy who has created it. And so what the studies have shown is take a look at these countries that have tried to create jobs through the direct government job creation, trying to have the government doing it from their national capitals, like we're trying to do it from Washington. And what you find is that they have no reduction in unemployment. In some cases, you actually have higher unemployment. The government is taking with one hand, and you can see the jobs that are being funded, but you don't see the jobs that would have been created if that money had been left in the private sector. It simply doesn't work. It's private businesses and entrepreneurs who are the only way to create lasting jobs, not through taxes and spending.
James, how did we move from 12% unemployment in 1937 to 1.2% in 1943?
Well, if you take a look at that's an excellent question. If you take a look at the war economy, basically the economic statistics of the time are unreliable because we'd mobilized the economy. So, yes, you've got you basically drafted the unemployed and had them in the Pacific or in Europe. But this wasn't exactly a time of economic prosperity. You had rationing. You had even if you could had the money income to, say, buy meat or milk, you also needed to have the ration coupons. So the economic statistics weren't really telling us what was going on in the economy. The interesting thing is what happens after the war, after all those rations and those controls are taken off. And that's when we see the troops return and we actually do have low unemployment. And why was that? Well, the reason was we'd opened up a trade with our allies, the Smoot-Hawley, which was a terrible idea. The tariffs that shut down international trade. A lot of that was undone with the Marshall Plan and opening up trade with Europe. That a lot of the New Deal regulations had actually been repealed by that point. And so that you had a climate much more favorable to entrepreneurs, and people were much more willing to invest in that post-war era, that era of opening up international trade and commerce.
Mary Bluestone, what was your point in asking the question?
Well, the point is that, in fact, it was government spending that got us up to a 4.5% to 5% growth rate during World War II, got us unemployment of 1.2%. And when we got after World War II, we actually had massive government spending. We had the Korean War. Then we had the National Defense Highway Act, the Interstate Highway Act, which spent billions and billions of dollars to crisscross the country. We had an expansion in government spending and an expansion in military spending. And that was government spending that kept America at work.
So why aren't two wars right now having the same effect on America?
Well, those two wars are tiny compared with World War II. And in fact, what's happened is that we had a housing crunch, a housing meltdown, we had a banking crisis, and then we've had this set of deregulations of a number of sectors, but particularly banking, all rolled up at once, which have left tens of millions of people unemployed.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. 1-800-423-TALK. Beth is calling from Schenectady, New York. Hi, Beth, and thanks.
Hi. Well, I was going to say that I think that the idea, I'm going to touch on two points quickly. One of your commentators mentioned education and the poor black man. Something like 70 or 80% of Americans can't afford a bachelor's degree. So education, I don't think, is necessarily the issue. And the government can either give grants or tell employers, we're going back to the time when you had to train your employees. Either we'll give you grants for it, or you're just going to have to do it, because it really sets up a pay-to-play mentality. I've been in line for jobs where I don't want to tell you what I do for a living, and I can tell what they're looking for. They're not looking for the skill set. They're looking at who is dressed the best, who fits a certain mentality of the upper middle class person. And I wanted to also mention the Marie Antoinette comment had to do with the fact that Marie Antoinette supposedly thought people had just run out of bread and could go eat cake that was probably in the house. But mostly it's a pay-to-play mentality. And most Americans can't afford to pay to play. And that is the real problem of the issue.
Beth, thank you very much. Catherine Newman, weigh in.
I'm not sure I follow Beth's point, to be honest. But I think I'll just pick up on the point she made about the affordability of education. I think one of the things that worries me most about the retrenchment in state-level spending is the way it's affecting our major training mechanism, which is the nation's junior colleges. When Americans are turfed out of the labor market, they often do the constructive thing, which is to return to school and look to build up new skills so that they can shift to new areas where there might be job growth. But one of the major mechanisms for doing that is the nation's junior college system, and we're seeing it hemorrhage. It's shutting its doors because it's overwhelmed by people trying to come back for exactly what they ought to do, which is gain new skills, at the same time that there's a budget crisis in the states and they just can't absorb any more students. So another issue that worries me besides leaving people on the sidelines is making sure that our training system, whether it's by private employers or by public sector higher education, stays intact and able to help people make changes toward areas which might grow in the future. If that breaks down, which is what's going on right now, then we don't provide our people any way to rationally respond to this crisis by giving them avenues for picking up new skills. So I know the Obama administration tried very hard to work on this by shunting more money in the direction of the community colleges. All that that did, unfortunately, was stave off layoffs to some degree for a short time. Those layoffs are cascading out now, and we're going to start seeing these institutions shut their doors. They already have shut them on thousands of students who are trying to get an education so that they can compete.
Are you at Princeton, Catherine Newman, and Barry Bluestone, are you at Northeastern seeing on your campuses an uptick in people trying to get into master's programs because they don't have work right now? Or are you seeing an uptick of people trying to finish up the work on that bachelor's program, bachelor's degree that they dropped out of years ago because they went to work? Catherine, you first.
Well, at Princeton, certainly we do see an avalanche of people applying for master's programs and doctoral programs. Education is a countercyclical industry, so there's no great surprise here, but it is absolutely astounding. Certainly in my department, it was about 100% increase in the number of applicants. We don't see students returning at the bachelor's level because that's not how Princeton's organized, but I'm sure that's not true for Barry at Northeastern, and I certainly know that that's not true in the public sector. The City University of New York, again, is absolutely standing in the midst of a tidal wave of applicants. For the first time in its entire history, it shut down taking applications in the spring term for the following fall. That's never happened before, and it's because they're so overwhelmed by people attempting to come back to school to do exactly what they should do. Gain new skills, look for a way to reinvent themselves, and hope that when they finish, the economy is turned around and they can use those new skills to find new employment.
Barry, at this time, in this crisis, should colleges rethink the way they're offering programs? Should they look at what jobs that are out there right now? Should they be more focused on job training as opposed to broad-based liberal education?
Well, I think we should be doing both. And at Northeastern, where we have the co-op program, most of our students also have co-op employers and spend a lot of time in the workplace because we think education and experience going together give the best opportunity for future employment. Fact is we are being overwhelmed by students at Northeastern who are taking this opportunity to try and get the skills so they won't be unemployed like some of their parents.
Victor is on the phone from Atlanta, Georgia. Hi, Victor.
Hey, Bob. I just want to let you know, I got a friend who has a master's degree in special ed and a minor in mathematics and cannot find any job anywhere. Nobody's even talking to her on under jobs because they're saying she's overqualified. The state labor department won't let her retrain in the colleges because they're saying she's overqualified already. She don't need training. And I work in the transportation industry, and we used to absorb a lot of the unemployed back in the 70s because it was a job that would create enough wealth for somebody from middle management or lower to survive. And transportation has stagnated to the point where our salaries hadn't moved up any in the last 15 years compared to inflation. And that's the whole thing, that so many people don't realize that the working people are being squished. And now that so many are unemployed from middle class can't even find anything in the working level because the salaries are so low, they didn't realize how much of a drop it would be. And a lot of them just can't find nothing because no employer wants to take them. Because if you're used to making $100,000 a year, or like my teacher friend is making only $60,000 a year, no Walmart's going to hire her, even just as a clerk. And she's about to lose her house because of that.
So what do you want from Washington?
They need to work toward, they got to extend unemployment, but they got to do something to help employers, give them incentives to hire some of these people who are overqualified, give them some kind of incentive. Say, look, we'll give you a tax break if you'll hire somebody that's got a master's degree for this clerk job until the job creation comes back. Because until jobs come back, if you keep forcing more and more middle-class people out of work, it's just going to stagnate the economy even more to the point where, you know, it's a spiral effect. There's got to be a point where we stop the spiral.
Okay, Victor, thank you very much for your comments. Last word from our three commentators, our three guests, and we'll start with James Shirk.
Well, I certainly don't think the government should be playing favorites in a situation like that. All that any sort of tax break along those lines would do would be to get the government or to get the business to hire the guy with the master's instead of the guy who had the associate's degree from a community college. But I don't think the government should be picking winners and losers. But what we do need to do is get the economy back on track in a way that encourages private businesses to expand. A lot of what we've been doing recently is not helpful. The health care reform bill, higher taxes, massive new regulatory load on businesses. Just the paperwork burden is going to be enormous on a number of these firms.
Okay, James. James, we're going to interrupt you there. Catherine Newman, last word from you.
We have to put the nation back to work. I'm in favor of any mechanism that will help that happen. I have no problem with the private sector weighing in. I think that's not going to happen as long as they can solve their problems through higher productivity, which is exactly why they aren't hiring people. It's not because they're worried about taxes. It's because they can squeeze more work out of the workforce they've got.
And thank you, Catherine. I'm sorry we're running out of time. And Barry Bluestone.
We've got to stimulate the economy. Best way to do it, let's extend those benefits now.
Barry Bluestone, labor economist at Northeastern University, Catherine Newman, labor sociologist at Princeton, and James Shirk, labor economist, senior policy analyst at the Heritage Foundation. Thanks, all three, for joining us today. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Bob Oakes, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.